Kia ora, talofa, namaste, haere mai, and welcome to this week's episode of The Nichecast. We are here to deliver some Aotearoa sporting yarn and kōrero, and as a bit of a warm-up, couple throw-down, swing the leg, get the blood flowing, I want to drop some Andrew Webster Aotearoa Warriors coaching notes fresh off my breakdown of what to expect from Andrew Webster as Warriors coach. And I am curious about your thoughts, Wildcard, about what you see as common traits in the good NRL coaches. As a illustrious Dragons fan yourself, fresh, you're in the experience of a mediocre coach in Anthony Griffin and fairly mediocre organization, so you've got a good perspective here for Warriors fans as well. But I'm curious about your views on the common traits of good NRL coaches.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this is clouded by the Anthony Griffin stuff, but I would say, in contrast to him and his very like old school mentality, I think the best coaches these days do have a more modern approach. They are not hefty on the like data analytics side, because I just don't think you got to keep it relatable in the NRL, but also you got to at least have an open mind to different ways of doing things and a modern progressive style of play. But also that works if you can connect with your players, and I think the best examples do also include dudes who can communicate, can respond, who have good relationships with their players. Like I know everyone, the thing about Craig Bellamy, who's, you know, the most successful coach of the last 5 to 10 years, the only guy this century who can compete with him is Wayne Bennett. It's like those two, 1 and 2, and then everything else. Both those guys, Bellamy and Bennett, both have reputations for being quite like gruff and abrasive. But then you also see these things where they have these amazing relationships with their players. Like they get on fantastically with their dudes. Like the best example is old Brandon Smith taking the piss out of Bellamy at any opportunity. Like the reputation that he has suggests like almost a blow up spittle on the screen of the coach's box kind of thing. You wouldn't expect that to be the case, but clearly very relatable relationship going on there between coach and player, which I think is maybe the most important thing, because none of the other stuff, you can't get your ideas through if you don't have that sort of like bridge as well. So that's where I'm leaning, and I don't think the Dragons have that. I think the Dragons have that in a couple of players, specifically those who used to play for old mate at old Hook, they call him, at the Broncos. The ones who don't have a previous Brisbane connection, there's definitely like the in team and the out team. Like I think there's a couple factions within that squad. Not a good thing. Maybe the Warriors are trending in a much better direction for that reason, because I don't see that kind of stuff going on with them at the moment. But that's more for you to say, I think.
I was going to say the Warriors don't have criminal cases in their squad, but I think there is that Josh Curran situation, which I'm not sure what's happening there. So there may be some similarities and differences, but I think every NRL club has a criminal situation in it, which is fun.
It's the NRL, so
the coaching. So I think that is a very fair note, and I think that's a possibility for Andrew Webster. Like all signs are positive, as they are for many coaches at this stage of their head coaching season or year. But that's where you're going to see the most, the connection is most evident in defense. And I don't think, and this is my first note about Andrew Webster, I don't think like he's going to be, defense wins championships. So the Warriors are not going to win a championship, and they're not going to have championship defense. Like, that is unrealistic to expect that to be the case. You just need good enough defense to make it in the finals, and I think that's what the Warriors are aiming for. And Andrew Webster's connection to the players will be on display in their defensive performance, because those improvements are based on effort and attitude, care for your players, your coaching staff, and the organization. So that's a key indicator of Andrew Webster's influence, is just the defensive effort and attitude but it doesn't need to be elite defense. It just needs to be good enough, because that's all they're aiming for, is just finals. Like, we're not defense wins championships. The Warriors aren't going to win a championship, so we can lower that bar a wee bit. Second point is just some interesting crossover, because you've got Webster, who worked under Andrew McFadden previously with the Warriors. Then McFadden departs. He goes to the Raiders as an assistant coach to Ricky Stewart, pretty successful at the Raiders. He returns to the Warriors as a general manager of Pathways Development and Recruitment with Andrew Webster as the coach. So they're a bit of a team, and that shows the connection Webster has to the Warriors and that knowledge, as well as the experience around him with Andrew McFadden, who shares more experience. Then you've got the Ivan Cleary relationship, where Cleary was one of the most successful Warriors coaches there has been. Then he goes to the Panthers, and Webster joins him at the Panthers and has championship experience with Cleary at the Panthers. Quite similar organizations, Panthers and Warriors, when you think about the cultural makeup of their squad and their club franchise and their connection to the community. So, like, Webster's got all that experience with Ivan Cleary, and Ivan Cleary's experience stems from his time at the Warriors. Like, he's taken a lot of the understanding and growth he had at the Warriors into this Panthers role, and now Webster gets to put into practice everything he learned from Ivan Cleary back at the Warriors. So it's a weird crossover there, but it's part of, like, a, I don't know what coaching tree this is. It might be the Ivan Cleary coaching tree, because now we've got Seraldo and we've got Webster. So the major coaching trees, you go, I think it's like, I'm not too deep in the history, but you can, the modern one is Wayne Bennett, Craig Bellamy, but he's even from like the Tim Sheensy, Wayne Bennett type of coaching tree as well. And then you've got Webster, who was an attacking coach at assistant coach in charge of attack at the Panthers. So while his defense just needs to be good enough, and much of that is based on the connection with the players and the culture, chemistry, Webster's impact will be most evident in how the Warriors attack, and by that I'm meaning how the forwards are passing between each other, the crispness of their shapes, and how different players like put in their best positions. Where it's like this edge forward always, like, he does his best work running this line, and our shape is designed to highlight his best attributes, as opposed to like this player, we're just going to give him the ball here because that's what we do with every player, and we've got a generic shape that doesn't do anything to highlight their best attributes. I think a good attacking coach like Webster is going to be finely tuning those details and just game control. I think he's quite a interesting character to have leading someone like Sean Johnson, who is now in a different phase of his career where he's all about managing and controlling the game. And you've got Webster, who just had fresh experience of Nathan Cleary and his game management and how you can control a game and dictate a game while you've got the footy. So just some key ideas about Andrew Webster, fresh off the big yarn today, that is up live on our website, thenews-case.com.
Yeah, good yarn. Have a read of it. What else have we done the intro? Or what? I got nothing else to add. You've written it all down. I thought you just kind of go straight through. But
you got any more podcast notes on Webster? As a layman, as a Warriors muggle, how do you feel about the Webster situation? Did I fill
Warriors
you with...
Muggle is an early candidate for episode title, I think.
Because you asked me, like, I did the cautious optimism about the Warriors and the Black Caps, then you asked me, like, for further information about the cautious optimism for the Warriors. So I've laid out even more information about the cautious, optimistic vibe I have about the Warriors, this time based solely around Andrew Webster. What's your response as a Warriors muggle around that cautious optimism?
I find it hard not to share it, if I'm being totally honest. I think they've done some smart work. I really like the Webster hiring. I think he's a clever, modern, relatable coach who fits a lot of those things I was talking about at the start. And I just think that's the first step. Like, when you've got that in place, a lot of other things can fall into place. And, like, I've I've just seen too many examples across the sporting world where it's like people might have an expectation that these players are bad because they've played in a bad team sort of thing. And then you get a better coach with a better system who's able to, for whatever reason, get more out of those players, and suddenly they look a lot better. I think that Warriors squad is a lot stronger than people realize, and I kind of think they underperformed to where they finished last season. Like, they could have been a fringe top 8 team for the talent that they had. They just didn't have a way of getting the best results for that talent. Like, they didn't play. They had too many lapses. They had games where they got absolutely blown out, where it's like, what's going on here? Like, there's one thing to lose, it's another thing to have thrashings kind of thing. And so I just think there was some, I don't know, I think it was for whatever reason, and unfortunately has happened a few too many times for the Warriors over the last decade, but they'd reached that point once again in their cycle where they just needed to hit the reset button. But the reset button doesn't have to mean wholesale changes, and it's going to take 4 years for them to get back to any kind, like, to get through a rebuild. It might be a sudden thing. They could make the top 8 this season. It might just be as simple as get some of these guys playing in their best positions, get them playing in a style that suits them a little bit better, get them a little more engaged defensively, and that all stems from having not just a good coach, but a good coaching staff. Because I think often people also put too much pressure just on the one man. Whereas a good coaching, like a good head coach has good assistants. It's quite important. Like, it's extremely important. One guy can't be everywhere for starters, let alone the fact that a diversity of ideas is always going to be a good thing, as long as everyone's open-minded and willing to, like, consider and adapt and things like this. So they're not going to be a team that's going to be pushing top 4. I don't see them making that leap anytime soon, and probably not for at least a couple of years, even if things work to the plan. But they might make the top 8 this season. Like, it's not that in the NRL, where there's a lot of fluctuation from year to year outside of the top couple of teams, that's definitely not out of the realms of possibility. And I think they've had a strong offseason. I think they've recruited in quite, not flashy ways, but quite clever ways, which is probably also a good improvement in itself, like buying players who fit a need for the team rather than just being like, yeah, Reece Walsh, superstar, let's do this. I like that. I like where they're going. But of course it's the Warriors, so you have to keep that cautiousness with the optimism. You can only get burnt so many times before you're a little bit hesitant to reach out like that, you know? Don't touch the stove.
Which is, yeah, very important to note, because the reality is that most Warriors coaches suck. There has been 2, maybe 3 decent Warriors coaches out of 14. So, again, we need to reality, expectations, no expectations, hopeful that the Warriors can crack the top 8. Also absorbing waves of context about the majority of Warriors coaches not being very good, and that is the history of the Warriors, and generally just cursed matters, as we always discuss. Big up the Patreon whānau, patreon.com/ourNicheCache, ELNicheCache. It is the best way to support the Niche Cache straight up the guts. We do an extra podcast every week for the Patreon whānau, and we do encourage the Patreon whānau to chime in with ideas and drive that Patreon podcast. So regardless of whether you care about the Patreon podcast and the topics we discuss, it is the best way to support all our content, the yarns on the website, the email distribution as well via Substack, and the podcast. However you get the podcast, the best way to support everything is through Patreon, patreon.com/ourNicheCache. Sign up and you also get extra podcasts every week. Every Monday and Friday, we send out our email newsletter via Substack. You can also sign up to subscribe to that as a paid member and get access to the Patreon podcast. Or you can just sign up and get that email sent to you every Monday and Friday evening, chock-a-block full of Aotearoa spawning information. Sign up there at thenichecache.substack.com. And of course, all Aotearoa sporting yarn and kōrero can be found on our website, thenish-cache.com. The Football Ferns preview is still relevant after their first game against USA. We've got plenty of Warriors coverage. We got the six juniors you need to know about. We got the forward pack breakdown. We got the spine breakdown. We got the coach breakdown. That's all there for your Warriors needs. We got domestic cricket, best youngsters in Super Smash. Got the White Ferns mixer, looking forward to their T20 World Cup squad. We got a big old Stephen Adams yarn. Are you doing a Wellington Phoenix woman yarn as well coming up?
Certainly got one of those coming up. I'm also at some point hoping to finish a bid on just like the five top players from last year at the Wellington Phoenix Academy, in line of the fact that every year there's like three or four new guys pushing towards first team capabilities. Well, I got to get in ahead of the thing so when they start making the first team, I can be like, here's an article where I told you so. Flying Kiwis is up live. There's a Stephen Adams thing from last week, which is still pretty good on the old focusing on his rebounding and defensive efforts so far this season, specifically over their recent winning streak. So that's all still relevant because they're still on that winning streak. Lots of stuff.
Big up yourself. Big up Aotearoa. Big up the niche case, theniche-case.com. We always start with mindfulness. Well, we're not starting. We're in the mindfulness segment. So let's have some mindfulness.
Yeah, apologies for picking another Ram Dass quote, but this one was really good, and I couldn't not. The quote goes, "We are moving towards a light that embraces darkness."
I think a lot of people would, you know, and myself included, as always, we assume that the light, there is no darkness. Like, you go through the darkness.
The light defeats darkness, kind of thing.
Yeah, you go through the darkness to get to the light. The light at the end of the tunnel. But to really be engaged with the light, you have to be aware of the darkness, and you have to be present with the darkness. You have to be comfortable with the darkness being there, which is evident in the day-to-day. Like, there's a lot of darkness floating around. But as long as you're aware of it, as long as you know it exists, that helps you, you know, that drives some gratitude for the light. That drives some connection with the light as well.
And the fact is, the darkness will always be there. Like, you're not ever going to actually outrun that. That's not how it works. And if you did, like, could you imagine an existence where you were 100% happy 100% of the time? Like, you wouldn't actually be happy at all, would you? That's not happiness if you're just always happy the entire time. That's complacency is what that is. Like, that's within minutes, that's what that would become. You actually, this is like the most generic kind of Disney movie version of it, just the happy versus sad. But like, if you don't experience sadness, happiness has no context. Like, it's meaningless. It's not even a thing. It becomes just the instead of being the thing above default, like one moving in one direction is happiness, moving in the other direction is sadness, and in the middle is like, I don't know, an equilibrium or something like that. If happiness becomes the default setting, it's no longer happy. I probably should have been using light and dark to make the thing. Like, if light is the to keep the mindfulness consistent, if light is your default setting, then it's actually not light anymore because it's lost its meaning. It's lost its relevance. You know, yin and yang, I guess.
I love living in Aotearoa, and I love being from Aotearoa because you experience every type of weather.
Yeah, it was sunny at the football in Wellington yesterday.
Right,
what
so
do you
this
know?
you really experience everything about the seasons and the weather, and the sunshine we have in summertime right now is so good. A couple of weeks ago, I was pissing down with rain the whole time. So it's like that being aware of the darkness, being aware of how some days are going to be shitty and rainy, does allow you to tune in and tap in with the glorious light and the sunshine and the good weather. How about that? As you mentioned, pretty sunny down in Wellington there. Football ferns were really good first half. I thought they were pretty solid in the first half. And then USA, the women's team, America. They just kind of smoked the football fans in the second half, which was to be expected. Like, for keen football observers, some of those who were part of a 12,000-ish crowd.
12 and a half, yeah.
Yeah, which is decent. I think a lot of people going to be surprised at how many women's football fans there are when the World Cup is in Aotearoa. I think that was a pretty good sign of it already at the Caketon there in Wellington. How did you feel about that football fans performance? Because I lost my point there. I think a lot of football fans know the vibe. And so it was kind of like, oh, we get to see USA play against Aotearoa. We get to see some of the best players in the world play on our home turf. So there was kind of that respect from the Kiwi football fan for the best team in the world. And like being able to watch them, being able to see them in the flesh live. And it wasn't like, oh my God, the football fans suck because they're getting those USA scoring goals. That respect combined with like an admirable performance given the situation, the reality of these two teams, it was a pretty fun all-round game. Second game coming up this weekend. How did you feel about the football fans' performance given the scoreline?
Yeah, I think there's two sort of distinct aspects to this game and to this tour in general. One is like the, and I think maybe the most important thing is the off-field stuff, where for America, what they wanted to do is, in the one window of opportunity that they had, they wanted to come to New Zealand, they wanted to test out the training facilities, which they're going to be using for the World Cup. They wanted to experience the travel, get a little bit of a vibe for the culture and the setting. They're going to play a game at, they played that game at Sky Stadium in Wellington. They're playing one at Eden Park in Auckland, specifically the two stadiums where their games are going to be during the World Cup group stage. Like, this is all preparation for the World Cup for them. Plus, it's a training camp. And when they announced it, they talked about it being a training camp. They didn't say, this is our squad for the friendlies against New Zealand. They said, this is our squad for the training camp in New Zealand. The fact they play friendly games as well is just kind of a bonus thing. And I mean, I'll come back to that because that's not what your question was about. But I do think that's maybe the more important thing, because there's the flip side for the football ferns, in that they knew they were going into it with an understrength team, which was probably going to get thrashed. So, but there was, you know, there's more on that. I'll come back to that. But as far as the performance goes, they were, I mean, the funny thing is the last time they played against South Korea, because they were missing, I think Ali Riley was injured, CJ Bolt was injured, they ended up picking a back four that just had four centre-backs. Like, I think Michaela Moore played on the right, Liz Anton played on the left, I think. Claudia Bunge and Katie Bowen through the middle, I think was how it went. So four centre-backs across your back four, and that's not the first time Klimkova's done that either. Admittedly, Anton can play a bit of fullback, and Michaela Moore can play a bit of fullback. Like, they've done that before. It's not fresh to them. Don't know how often Ali Riley's played centre-back before, but she actually, I thought, was the best performer within that back four. So, flip to this American game, four fullbacks across the back four. You've gone from four centre-backs to four fullbacks. And I thought that was going to be trouble. I thought that's, like, I quite like Ashley Ward as a left back. I think she's really good, but, you know, she doesn't have the pace to deal with the wingers that the USA team have. No one in our team does. It's like there's no solution to that problem. It's just deal with it and hope they miss a few open goals. And they actually did miss a few open goals across the way. But the organization from the back four was pretty good. Thought they did get dragged wide a little bit too much, which is probably to be expected from four fullbacks. They don't necessarily feel as comfortable in the central areas, whereas I think when they played four centre-backs, you often saw that back four being quite compact because the wide centre-backs are pushing inwards where they're more used to being. So there's a little bit of that, a few things. But on the whole, they were pretty well organized. And I thought especially their midfield, which was the least affected by the changes, because Betsy Haas would probably be starting anyway. Daisy Cleverley is a backup, but she's started plenty of Ferns games before. Liv Chance would definitely be starting on the left. And I think Grace Jale should be our first choice right midfielder as well. Whether she is or not maybe depends on what she does over the next couple months leading into the World Cup. Like, it's there to be proven still. I think that spot is up for grabs. As much as any spot in the team right now is the right midfield, trying to figure out that one. But I think Grace Jale should be it. So if that's the case, you've got arguably three of your four top players in the first choice players in the midfield, which was not the case in defense. The only first choice player there was playing out of position, not the case in goal, not the case up front. And I thought the midfield was absolutely fantastic, especially in that first half. You had Hassett and Cleverley getting... They were covering good ground. The wide defenders were getting back. Hassett and Cleverley were winning tackles. They were pressuring their midfield. It did change in the second half. But the fact that they had a scoreless half there in those circumstances is already a positive. Like, that's already something to take away from that game. Of course, second half, yeah, USA, who played the first half, I thought, like it was a preseason friendly, which is exactly what it is, because all those players are in their preseasons, and it was a friendly where they were really here for a training camp. So it was a preseason friendly for those players, and they played like it in the first half, some like sloppy misses, and just not the intensity you expect. Probably got a bit of a rack up at halftime, because they came out, made one or two subs, bit more intensity, bit more like just moving the ball quicker and also moving the ball earlier rather than slow build up. They started playing the ball longer a few times and exposing our lack of pace at the back. And yeah, so it goes. They scored four goals in a hurry. It could have been less, but it also could have been more. Like, they always had the potential to do that. But thanks to that first half, I think the Ferns end up taking a fair bit from this game on the, like, from the performance side of things. As I was going to say later, like, they definitely took stuff from the game outside of the performance itself. Like, there's other stuff to be gained, which was why they're playing these friendlies. But they got more from this than I thought on the field as well, which is good. That's a good sign. It's a nice, another nice step for them to heading towards that World Cup.
Second game is in Auckland on Saturday or Sunday?
Saturday, I believe.
Saturday. So
same time, another 4 o'clock kickoff.
Prime time. What? Yeah. Would you be looking for as far as improvements or development? Like, I think it's good to look, like, work with both ideas, work with a bit of the light and the dark, the short term and the long term. What are you thinking as far as, like, immediate improvements to make a, to have a more competitive showing in the second game? And then how those improvements or developments work in the long term vision of the Football Ferns, which incorporates the World Cup and trying to have a good showing there.
Well, I suspect that the USA might rotate their team a bit in order to get more players, to get everyone some game time. It's seems like the just the thing you would do on a training camp thing. So I wonder, there was a pretty strong starting lineup that they picked for that game, probably as strong as they had available to them. They do have several players, particularly attackers, out injured at the moment, so they're not, they don't have the same drama as we do with player availability outside of an international window, but they do, you know, they're not at full strength. There's a few famous faces that weren't there. I think they might be slightly weaker, because this is, of course, relative. Their second 11 is going to be a lot better still than our first 11, most likely, but they're likely to rotate things up a little bit. Might actually have the opposite effect, where players are hungrier for positions and they play better, I don't know. But I also think we will have a slightly stronger lineup for the second game. So, you know, some of those A-League players who travelled back and were only able to play off the bench would be available to start. I think you'll be able to find a couple centre-backs along that crew, which means Ali Riley can hopefully play left-back, and that also strengthens things. And you just got to hope, and from that point then that... I don't know. The defense is always pretty good for the Ferns, is the thing. Like, I was surprised that such a makeshift back four was able to withstand USA as much as they did. But they're always a good defensive team. They have good defensive players. They knuckle down. Their weakness by far is just don't create enough chances, therefore don't score enough goals. And they didn't really create much against the Americans in the first game. So maybe with a slightly stronger lineup, they might be able to do a bit more of that in the second game. Like, that's definitely what we want to see. I don't know exactly how they're going to get to it, but if they can create a few more chances against the Americans, maybe get a little bit more of a press going against their back four or things like that. But of course, that's risky, because if they play through it, as they're likely to do, then you're undermanned and they're just going to run through you. So it's tricky, and this is one of the reasons why it's a little bit of a difficult series to get a handle on. Because it's kind of hard to know exactly what are you supposed to do against the best team other than play valiantly and lose. But even that, just minutes on the field together, and like there might not be anything obvious to be gained from this one game, but as part of a longer process, that matters. Like in a World Cup year, that matters. Those things are important.
You mentioned the biggest need is attacking impetus, bit of pizzazz, bit of panache, bit of razzle dazzle in the attacking zone. Was there anyone who showed that spark in the first game, or someone in the squad? Because as you mentioned, it's not a full strength squad. So is there someone in the squad who might get some more game time in the second fixture and showcase some of that attacking flair? Because I think a player who does show some attacking flair and can help the Football Ferns attacks create chances, score goals, could play their way into the World Cup squad from further down the depth chart.
Definitely. It's not like anything is settled when the team doesn't score any goals. Anyone who can is automatically going to have to be taken seriously. I mean, their best creative player is Liv Chance, and there were a couple of flashes towards the end of the game. She got into a little bit of space. It's more about getting the ball to her in those positions, which is very hard to do when you're sitting at least 10 players behind the ball at both times of the game, because the other team's got all the possession. It's hard to get your left midfielder up into those areas where she can be influential like that, but figuring out some way to do that would be important. We know what Liv Chance can do. I think Grace Jarley still is someone who could offer a little bit in that regard, because she's a rare thing, and it's probably more pronounced watching it against America, where all their players are just super athletic. Like, they're all just really good athletes. We don't have that many of those, and Grace Jarley is an exception. She is tall, she is strong, she is fast, and she's got good technique. Very few players that we have tick all those boxes. She might be the only one, I'm not sure. There's definitely not very many at the moment, and that's just not something to be ignored. I mean, there's players like, I think Paige Satchel had quite a nice impact off the bench. I low-key prefer her playing off the bench. She's been a regular starter under Kumkova, and I get why, because she has an X factor that is going to at least ask a question of every team she plays against. But also, yeah, you can kind of deal with the fact that she's super fast by just guiding her wide, where her crossing and shooting just isn't as effective. Like, coming off the bench where it's a change of pace to put a player like that, no pun intended, but it's just switching things up on the fly, I think might actually be more effective if she's playing 30 minutes like that. But I expect she'll probably start in the second game, and hopefully will, you know, do a few things, because it's not just the running with the ball. I thought her closing down was quite effective because of her pace there as well. And if you're catching an American team who's in preseason mode, you might just be able to, you know, get someone lingering on the ball and turn that over, and then hopefully you've got another striker close enough to help, like, take advantage of that. But getting players forward is another problem for the Ferns. But these are ongoing things that they're trying to work through. And honestly, how they do against America isn't the gauge of their success. They're not going to a World Cup expecting to win the whole World Cup, so it doesn't really matter what you can do against the two-time defending champs. They want to win a game. They want to beat the Philippines, or maybe get a draw against Norway, or maybe even beat Switzerland and make the second round. Like, that's what they're aiming to do, and whether they can do it against America or not doesn't actually reflect on whether they can do it against Switzerland, you know? So it's more just about those reps again, and just little signs, little things that maybe, okay, it didn't work, but you can see the intention, and maybe against a slightly weaker team, it will work.
Yeah, you look at the USA team, you had Rodman came on in the second half, and she's a ball of energy down the flank. One of their midfielders is taller than everyone else on the field. And then,
yeah, Korniak, yeah.
And then you look at the Football Ferns team, and like, everyone's a similar size and stature, and is fast enough to play international football for sure, but they don't have X-factor speed, yeah, or strength or skill. Who was the playmaker chick for the USA team who was had this?
Rose Lavelle, yeah, who did the back heel assist. Yeah. She might be the best player in the world.
Yeah, so she's got like the X-factor skill set that Football Ferns don't have. And yeah, Grace Jarley did stand out as an athlete on the field, which says nothing about her footballing ability, but I did notice the difference in athletic prowess between the teams, and that's probably the most notable difference of the best team in the world, as we'd expect with, you know, Aotearoa Kiwis taking on Greece in a World Cup, or any other sporting example you can think of, where the Kiwis are the favourite, and they have, like, you think of the women's cricket, when the White Ferns take on Bangladesh, of course the whole skill set is different, but the athletic prowess of the White Ferns is completely different to the athletes in the Bangladesh women's cricket team as well. And I just noticed that as a major difference between the teams.
Yeah, and just that other point I was sort of saying I'll get back to. Like, I think as much as the on-field stuff is helpful, and also just the idea of getting the team together and doing some training sessions is helpful, even if not everyone is there, you're still getting something. You're still being able to build and get time together. I think because Jukka Kamkova came out in the press conference, from what I've seen in like quotes, and seemed quite, and Ellie Riley, I noticed it as well in her post-game things, that both of them sort of mentioned about how, like, you know, some people thought we shouldn't have even played these games sort of thing. And we showed them, you know, how passionate we are and how important this is. And I'm like, I don't pay enough attention to know who was critiquing them and saying the tour shouldn't go ahead. When I wrote about it, I was sort of being like, it's a shame that they're going to lose because of the difficulty of getting players together and everything like that, and the timing's not good. But I also remember writing like, well, America are coming here anyway because they're doing a training camp. Why would you not play against the world champs? Like, if they're offering you games, you might as well, even if it is way more beneficial to them than it is to you. And so I don't know if other people were critiquing the purpose for the series. I never felt that way, but I did feel like, you know, it's just a shame they can't get their best team together. But something that changed quite a lot for me over the course leading up to the game, let alone at the game itself, where you get 12,500 there. It's like people are turning up to watch the Americans. We've seen the Ferns play against America a lot and usually lose about 5-0. Never seen it in Aotearoa before. It's the first time America have ever played in this country, and people had a chance to go watch that. I've been feeling for ages, like, at no point has it felt like the wider country has an understanding of how big the Women's World Cup is going to be, how big it is globally. This was, I think, the first time. So this tour ended up actually being crucial off the field for the crowd, for the fans, for the wider culture, because we saw the best team in the world play. The chance to watch them, record crowd. This is what 2023 is going to be for the next 6 months. You know, that's enormous and absolutely invaluable, let alone the players getting to play in front of that crowd as well.
I have been working in Wellington Phoenix Epiphanies over the past week, old mate, and this started with a real, real deep appreciation of what the Wellington Phoenix are up to and being able to absorb the loss of Ben Wayne. As we've discussed in Patreon podcasts and the Variety Show, over the last few weeks, we did go deep into this for this week's Patreon podcast, so make sure you check that out if you are a member of the Patreon whānau. If you're not, that's what the type of things we do discuss on the Patreon podcast every Tuesday. So I've had that appreciation deepen and strengthen of the Wellington Phoenix system, the coaches, the depth, the talent development. I think it's all quite impressive, and that was on display in losing Ben Wayne and not really suffering too much, perhaps even, you know, a holistic gain considering the financial benefits that you get as well. And then I was just catching a bit of A-League highlights on the telly, and the show wraps up with a ladder, an A-League ladder. The Wellington Phoenix are fourth. Like, holy shit, the Wellington Phoenix are fourth in the A-League. What's doing there? Well, just some crystallization of some Wellington Phoenix ideas we've been talking about all season long. We felt like they were a good team that wasn't really a 8th, 9th, 10th ranked team in the A-League. They didn't necessarily start the season very well as far as wins go, but both of us agreed that there were many positive signs in what the Wellington Phoenix were doing, and that was with Ben Wayne. And now Ben Wayne's been gone and the Wellington Phoenix keep trucking along, and now they are fourth, and this sets up an interesting game against the Central Coast Mariners, who are second. Wellington Phoenix are fourth, Central Coast Mariners are second, and this game will go down on Sunday afternoon, another primetime slot. Is that, you said the football fans was Saturday, right? So this is Sunday?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's helpful.
I think the Phoenix
that's
women
helpful.
Might be playing on Saturday, though, afterwards. No one will be doing the double ups, though.
Yeah, as long as you don't got football fans and Wellington Phoenix at the same time, that would be annoying. But
both
pretty interesting
Sunday.
Game here for Wellington Phoenix wildcard against the Mariners. And how are you feeling about this game specifically, considering we're always talking about the vibe around the Wellington Phoenix, but how are you feeling about this game specifically as a pretty fair challenge for where the Wellington Phoenix are at?
I think it's the best challenge they could have possibly have for gauging where they're at and also for sort of proving where they're at. It's because basically, like, as you're saying, like the performances were not bad throughout the season. The performances have been pretty good. They deserved a lot more points than they got. They had this annoying tendency of conceding late goals and getting beaten from set pieces and just little sloppy things, missing a couple penalties. Like, just I think they dropped 12 points from winning positions in their first 8-10 games, whatever it was. If they had those points, if they'd held on to all their leads throughout the season, they would not be, like, they would never have been in that sort of 7th, 8th, 9th spot on the ladder. They've always only ever been, I keep trying to, you know, say this, they've only ever been just one good month of form. It's the same for every team in the A-League, actually, because it's outside of Melbourne City, it's real close. Sydney FC aren't what they have been. Melbourne Victory are what they were last season, but that wasn't a very good team. It's not what they usually are. There's one clear best team in the competition. And below that, it's up for grabs. And one good month of form changes everything and sends you soaring up the table with room to spare. Phoenix hadn't quite done that to this point, but Central Coast Mariners had. Central Coast Mariners have won 5 of their last 6 games. They're potentially the form team right now. And now they're sitting second on the ladder. Like, that's all it takes is a good run. Like, tie a few wins together and there you go. The Phoenix have won 2 1-0 wins away from home. First 2 clean sheets of the season, and they had to really scramble to get them both. One a little bit more than the other, but still. Like, that's half a month's good form. That's a fortnight of good form, and they're up to 4th. It just shows. Like, it doesn't take that much. And if they can get a, you know, if they can beat Central Coast, they're in a pretty healthy place. They drew with them at the start of the season. Central Coast obviously playing a little bit better these days than they were back then, or at least have, you know, hit their stride. Phoenix are hopefully hitting their stride about now. This is what that looks like. This is your opportunity to beat the team who set the example that you're trying to follow in terms of how to rise up that A-League ladder in a hurry and compete with the best. And I mean, fourth place doesn't sound flattering for the Phoenix this season. Like, it doesn't sound like something where it's like, well, damn, they're up to 4th, this is amazing. It's like, no, well, they're up to 4th, but they're not there yet. Like, there's room to go. They expect to rise higher. I don't think they've ever finished higher than 4th in a full season, so that just shows where they're at. Like, those expectations aren't unjustified. This is a good team, potentially as strong as the Phoenix had ever been. Like, I definitely think this is their best chance for a finals run, maybe ever. They have made a couple finals runs, but they've been as, like, the team that sneaks in there and then gets, you know, wins a couple games, and then there you go. This is a team that can go into finals games as a favorite. And we've had to wait to see them show that in terms of their results. Like, we just haven't seen it from them consistently week after week. Hopefully this is the start of a winning streak, which would do exactly that, because if they beat Central Coast on the weekend, I think a lot of people take notice.
I'm just checking the Breakers as well, because it is interesting that the Phoenix and the Breakers are top 4. Breakers are now 3rd, and they face Illawarra tonight. Thursday night, Thursday the 19th, they face Illawarra, who suck. So that's good. That's great.
Yeah, they've been struggling.
That's great news for the Breakers. Obviously, that game's happening tonight, so we won't dive deep into the Breakers. We will update them in the coming weeks when there's a nice window for that to happen. But it is interesting that both the Phoenix and the Breakers are top four teams in their Australian competitions. And sliding back to the Wellington Phoenix, is there something that is shifted or been tweaked, or just a player that has risen up in recent weeks for folks to track and keep an eye on in the Central Mariners game? Basically, is there an element of their footy or a player to highlight based off their recent success in this Mariners game on Sunday?
I think Mena are on it Sunday at 3 or something after. It might even be, I think it's another double header. I think they're both at home, where the women play at midday, 12:30, something like that, and the men are on it about 3. So it's a Sunday afternoon sorted. I think, the guy that springs to mind is Ollie Sale. And that doesn't necessarily seem like the obvious choice, or maybe it seems like too easy of a choice. I don't know, because he's a goalkeeper and goalkeepers are always important. But I would say he was not faultless in some of those wins that were turned into draws and losses throughout the start of the season. He was in such good form last season. His save percentage did drop a little bit this term to start things off, and he maybe not having the same impact on games that he had. I think he said this himself. It felt like something he was playing bad or making egregious errors or anything. It's just he wasn't making game impacting saves and really spurring his team on like that. He was sort of a little bit more of a passenger in a way that is not what Ollie Sale looks like when he's playing at his best. And I think in the last 2 weeks we've seen him a lot more impactful. We've seen him sort of vocal and energetic and just making saves where he's just he's by sheer force of will, you just know that they're not going to beat them from this opportunity. He's got this covered because he's Ollie Sale and he backs himself, kind of thing. And he did make that penalty save against Melbourne City late on as well. Not the first time he's been not every penalty had been scored against him before, but this was the first time he'd saved one, because previously Stephen Ugarkovic scooped one over the bar at the Eden Park game last season, I think it was. So that's the first penalty that was missed against Ollie Sale, but he didn't actually save it. He didn't get his hands to it. Whereas this one he did, and then the second one was sliced wide. So there we go. But I think that penalty save was quite big for him as well in terms of feeling like he was in it again, feeling like he was in the trenches again, which had maybe slipped him by a little bit. And I thought he was really good against who they beat most recently, Brisbane, wasn't it? And hopefully that means they've got their dominating goalkeeper back and his dominating kind of form. Because if that's the case, that's a good place to start for the Phoenix. You got a goalie, you can do stuff like that. You can make big saves and impact results and, tip that one over the bar in the 89th minute when you're 1-0 up, kind of thing, hypothetically. You got a goalie, he'll do those kind of things. That's as good as a goal, those saves like that. So big yarns for Ollie Sale. Hopefully this is the start of a quality rest of the season. I believe he's off contract at the end of the campaign. There was some buzz about him maybe moving to Europe at the end of last season. Nothing progressed there, but as a free agent, you've obviously got a bit more control. Other clubs will be a bit more interested, knowing they don't have to pay for stuff. So that's another factor there. It's not just Ollie Sale. Can he do this for the old, get the Phoenix on the finals run? It's also contract year Ollie Sale. And that matters, that's also quite important.
And I think even though the football fans had multiple goals scored against them, old Naylor was pretty good in goal and could have made that score could have been a lot worse for the football fans if Naylor wasn't in goal. Also with Ollie Sale, we got the captaincy thing. He was captain, then Alex Rufer returns, so that might have changed his vibe and mentality. And Alex Rufer, is he a certified first 11, or is it kind of he's competing with Ugarkovic and Clayton Lewis?
Yeah, I suspect he's probably the third wheel with Ugarkovic and Lewis. And the three of them are sort of competing for two spots. I think Lewis is always going to be there because he's a bit more of the ball player. And the other two are sort of... Ugarkovic is the disciplined guy. He's whereas well, I don't know how to explain it, because the Alex Rufus thing is that he holds his spot, he does his job, he tackles hard, he's a bit more of an enforcer. Yugarkovic is maybe, it's probably better rather than disciplined, because that's they all do that, like they all do their job. They wouldn't be playing if they didn't under Rufutella. That's one of the things he expects, is to be able to follow a game plan. But I think maybe Yugarkovic is a little bit more of a pure baller. He's a bit more of a technical, a little bit more slick in his passing. Rufus got some clever passing, though. He knows how to pick out a striker and how to switch the ball and stuff like that, which is deceptive. I don't think people necessarily think that, because he is the more defensive of the three options, the hard tackler type. But I don't know, he's got a good combination with Clayton Lewis going back a few seasons. Yugarkovic and Lewis have played pretty well together as well. They seem to be growing a bit of a combination. One of them good problems to have. And then if Nick Pennington is your fourth option, Nick Pennington's not really going to, it's not going to win the A-League as a starting central midfielder, but if he's your fourth choice, nothing wrong with that. You know, that's good depth.
Let's wiggle into a bit of cricket. We have the Black Caps in India. Their Black Caps B team has taken on India B team, and that's cool. We will be loosely following that. Plenty of other, probably more meaningful Aotearoa sport happening at the moment. So we're just trying to go big picture with Kiwi cricket here. Closer to home, domestic cricket, we got Ford Trophy and a little bit of HBJ Shield. There's one HBJ Shield women's one-day cricket this weekend. So it's in a weird phase where Super Smash and one-day cricket are being intertwined. I said in the youngster debrief for the Super Smash, we're going deep in the mangroves, and you got the Super Smash estuary, you got the, you know, Ford Trophy estuary, then you got the HBJ Shield estuary coming from this way, and it's all just coming into the one big domestic cricket mangrove situation. So we've got a lot of estuaries of Kiwi cricket happening here. This weekend, though, starting tomorrow, Friday, we've got a monster dose of Super Smash. So we got Super Smash games Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Beautiful. Men's and women's. Women's White Ferns squad for the T20 World Cup should be named over the next few days. So don't think anything that happens in the next Super Smash games is going to impact White Ferns T20 selection. Might just throw up some ideas here, because I am curious to see what White Ferns coach Ben Sawyer does as far as his observation of the Super Smash. I don't think there's going to be any drastic changes to the best White Ferns T20 squad. I think the benefactor could be Hannah Rowe, who I think has been more impressive on the White Ferns fringes ahead of someone like Molly Penfold. Hayley Jensen hasn't been that great in Super Smash, and she was okay in the Women's Big Bash League late last year, but in 2022, in the full year of T20 International Cricket, she was the best bowler. So that's a curious spot to keep an eye on as well. I always talk about the batting role players, so you got Lauren Downs being okay for Auckland, Brooke Halliday's just returned from injury, Georgia Plimmer's away with the under-19s. Rebecca Burns doesn't score a lot of runs, but she is a Wellington batter who plays aggressively. And I think the White Ferns, what they need in their T20 first 11, I think, is Rebecca Burns. Just as a batter, like just an aggressive batter. You don't necessarily need a Lauren Down. You don't necessarily need someone outside the group like a Kate Ibrahim or a Natalie Dodd coming into the team, because you've got Susie Bates, Amelia Kerr, Sophie Devine, Maddie Green, who are exceptional batters. In that team, I think you need a Rebecca Burns type of player who can just come out and hit the ball and keep the runs flowing. Still think you've got the spin trio. Well, I think Brooke Halliday is an interesting one there, because she is a lefty, and they will probably want a lefty in their batting lineup, but I don't think Brooke Halliday has done anything to warrant consistent first 11 T20 international selection. The spinners, Eden Carson, she's fantastic. Amelia Kerr is solid with the ball. She is a world-class batter whose bowling's just dipped off a wee bit, but that's okay. Fran Jonas was injured, and she's pulled out of the under-19 World Cup. So that's something to keep an eye on, because if Fran Jonas, if this injury lingers and she's unavailable, then you could open the spot up for Lee Casbrook, who is one of the best players in Super Smash. And she, like, her selection, she would be, she's perfectly fine to be a first 11 cricketer, but Eden Carson got her opportunity and snapped it up. Fran Jonas has been excellent for the White Ferns as well. So it's like, Casbrook should be there. She was treated harshly, perhaps unfairly, but the players who got the opportunity ahead of her have performed for the White Ferns. So it's just an awkward little spot for her to be in. But that will all be displayed. I wonder if the White Ferns, like, if the squad is announced over the next few days, I wonder if the White Ferns will be playing this weekend's round of Super Smash Cricket, because if they're not, then we go super deep in the women's cricket mangroves and we're like, okay, who are the best non-White Ferns playing in Super Smash who are actually going to help their teams win the Super Smash? Having written about Canterbury Woman and throwing up that stat in the variety show, all eyes should be on Canterbury. Amy Satterthwaite, best player in New Zealand. Kate Anderson, one of the best batters. She moved from Northland to Canterbury. She's exceptional. Gabby Sullivan, Missy Banks, best seamers. Satterthwaite and Anderson bowling, they're good. Fran Wilson's in their team. She's a former England international, I think. And you've also got, like, really, they're really good batters who are now playing an aggressive role in the Canterbury T20 batting unit with Nat Cox, Laura Hughes, taking that responsibility to score quickly around Satterthwaite. Bit of a bummer that Izzy Sharp is now away with the under-19 team, because she is probably one of the best young hitters in Aotearoa and would be really fun in the Super Smash as well. But it's a interesting situation where we're sparking up this White Ferns T20 situation with their World Cup coming up. At the same time, I'm curious about which players are going to help their Super Smash team win. Because Wellington are a really good Super Smash team. They're a Super Smash women's dynasty. But half their team's going to go into the White Ferns. So who knows what's going to happen. And maybe it's an opportunity for a team like Auckland. Because I can see a situation where Lauren Down and Molly Penfold, they might miss out on the T20 World Cup squad. Suddenly they're still playing Super Smash. And then Auckland's a good Super Smash team, because Wellington's out of the mix. Otago loses Susie Bates, maybe Hayley Jensen.
Yeah, I was just looking up the standings to get that exact idea, because when you said, well, the White Ferns might start ducking out, I thought immediately, well, Wellington's been going pretty good, haven't they? And I checked it, and they've won 6 out of 6, and sure enough, net run rate is miles better than anyone else in the competition. So, yeah, they are pretty good, and they're about to lose just a couple Kerr sisters. Sophie Devine, I don't think, has played that much Super Smash this season, has she? But she will be gone. They'd be losing Maddie Green. They'd be losing, you mentioned Lee Casbrook is an outside chance for selection. She might also be the one who stays behind and leads them to glory. But Rebecca Burns is another Wellingtonian, isn't she? So there's at least half your team.
Plymouth's already away.
She's already away with the 19s, yeah. So it's a lot of, you take half of the best team's best players out. In fact, you take the best players, which is half of the best team's team. I think that makes sense. I got there in the second attempt. That competition opens right up at that point. And Canterbury are 5-1. They've played the same amount of games. They've only lost one more game, which I am going to assume was probably against Wellington, although I don't know, but I'm just guessing by the respective records. They will lose a couple of players, but they won't lose them all. That really opens that competition right up, if that is the case. If they can sneak their White Ferns in for another game or two, then maybe that helps. But, and this was something that was known from the start as well, wasn't it? It's like, obviously, the 2020 World Cup takes precedent over everything else. It was known that Wellington would have their best players, and then everyone else sort of was probably thinking, like, well, we're going to struggle against them to start with, but maybe we can catch them down the back end if we can stay in contention, kind of thing. So, frisky areas for the thing, because how's it? Is it straight top two to the final, or there's like the top team goes to the final and the next two play a semi final or something, I think, isn't it? I can't remember, but if that's the case, like, Auckland are third with the 3-3 record, which means everyone is in contention still to finish third and potentially make a semi-final, if I'm not overshooting on that one and getting the format wrong. I'd better check that.
So the only player from Canterbury who might miss dip out of Super Smash is Leah Tohuhu.
Mm.
So Canterbury, yeah, sure, they might lose the best Aotearoa seamer there has ever been, but they have the two best Super Smash seamers in Gabby Sullivan and Missy Banks. So, you know, let alone the best player in Amy Satterthwaite and Kate Anderson. The thing we have learned about Wellington cricket is they do have the best junior pipeline, talent development. And how that looks without their white ferns will be really interesting. And it needs to be said, like, this is a fascinating measurement of Wellington's playing group and their depth. I don't want to just write them off because you lose half your team to the white ferns, you're not going to win the Super Smash, because Wellington might still have Lee Casbrick, Tamsin Newton. Their bowling attack, Amelia Kerr is really solid, and she gets respected as far as not trying to whack boundaries off her and all of that, but she's not among their leading wicket takers. I think Jess Kerr is consistently dominant. But then you're looking at Casbrick, Zara Jetley. They've got Nicole Baird, who's a slightly older player, but she's a wicket-taking spinner as well. Monika Singh is a lefty who's got a funky quiver of deliveries to go with maybe some all-round overs from Tamsin Newton, but they've still got quite a strong team. The issue for them is they also have players in the Under-19 World Cup, so that's another thing. Like, their best young talent that isn't playing Super Smash now because the white fern's there, they're not going to be able to come into the squad because they're at the World Cup, their own World Cup. So it's going to be really interesting as a gauge of what Wellington cricket's up to, what the women's setup there is up to, how competitive. And like, if they win the Super Smash, despite losing all their white ferns, that is incredible. And that will require me getting deep in the Wellington mangroves. Men's Super Smash is pretty interesting as well, just considering the context of the competition. But there are two players I want to highlight as a... And we'll tie this in with the wider Black Caps pivot as well, because I think this is a really interesting stage for cricketers like Ajaz Patel, Neil Wagner, both of whom... Neither of them is like a white ball international cricketer for New Zealand, but they can still command first 11 selection for even Super Smash. Like, they're always playing for a trophy. Wagner might not play Super Smash, but there's a chance Patel usually plays Super Smash. He's always there in the mix. Neither of them have been overly dominant in domestic cricket this season. And if we're thinking about the Black Caps pivot and how their team might look for the upcoming cricket in the Kiwis summer, I'd be paying attention to what Ajaz Patel and Neil Wagner are up to in the Super Smash. To the best of my knowledge, Wagner hasn't played a Super Smash game yet. And just as far as where those teams are situated on the table, because that might determine their role and their importance to their team. So just find that. ND are fifth with 2-3 record. CD are first. So CD got to first without Ajaz Patel. They had Jaden Lennox operating as their main spinner, and obviously a pretty good seam attack, really good batting unit as well. The other thing is that I think Super Smash success will be dependent on the cricketing middle class. And I read, like, this was hammered home in my youngsters report, where, like, a team like CD, they've got some youngsters floating around who play a game here, play a game here, but their only kind of funky youngster is Josh Clarkson, who is in the upper age limit of my imaginary youngster section. But the rest of that team is Ben Smith, Brad Shamoulian, Latutu Taylor's played some Super Smash, Dane Cleaver, fringe Black Caps wicketkeeper, Tom Bruce. You might get Seth Rance. You did have Doug Bracewell before he went away with Black Caps. There, even they've got Brett Johnson, I think he's the older brother of Troy Johnson from Wellington. He's a bit older as well. Jaden Lennox has been operating as their spinner. He's been around for a while. So Central are the best team, and they've got a lot of those middle-class cricketers. How that looks for Wellington, Wellington's quite good. They do skew younger. A lot of the younger players have struggled this season in Super Smash. Canterbury's an interesting team in this regard as well, because there are some really fascinating youngsters. I've mentioned Zach Folkes a lot. He took a wicket yesterday in the Ford Trophy. Willow Rourke, Fraser Sheet, those seamers. But you look at their batting unit, the dudes who scored the runs, Chad Bowes, Ken McClure, Cole McConchy, Cameron Fletcher, Todd Astle's getting game time. So when Canterbury want to turn the screws with the ball, it's Todd Astle, it's Cole McConchy. Blake Cobburn gets a decent run in Super Smash as well. So there are youngsters performing in Super Smash. There are teams who get a lot of value out of their youngsters. I think the best Super Smash teams have the most middle-class cricketers. And that's fringe Black Caps, and that's just really experienced domestic cricketers who can get the job done at this level without the ups and downs of form and inconsistency that you see with the young players.
And that's probably more important this season than most seasons as well, because this season, unlike every other year, the Black Caps are currently in December and January, have been away on a foreign tour. That normally doesn't happen. This is normally primetime test summer kind of areas. Instead, they've been in Pakistan. Now they're doing a little bit in India. And because of that, because it's been a relatively long tour with tests and ODIs and some T20s still to follow, it means a lot of players are being used. And it means that guys like, let alone the fact that there's already a few Black Caps, which leads into your sort of pivot, where a few guys who just in the last 12 months who have either been recycled on, think of like Martin Guptill or arguably a Jimmy Neesham maybe now as well, who have been kind of moved on from in the team, or guys who by their own volition have done this, Colin de Gronholm, Trent Bolt, Ross Taylor retiring as well, last summer, but still.
CD Jiggy.
Yeah, de Gronholm, yeah. There's that creates room for five more players to go and play in these current Black Caps tours. They're already using more players because not everyone is going there from day one of the test series to the final T20 against India. That means a lot of international players are not playing Super Smash. Even players who wouldn't have been international players before, like Henry Shipley, they're over doing their own thing overseas. Like, the middle class and that sort of fringe depth is more important now than ever, because every team has been affected by this. It's how you win domestic titles. It's being able to roll with the punches. You can't just rely on your best players to be there and available, particularly in the Super Smash because of the timing of the season. You got to have that core team who you know are going to, like, that core to your team who you know are going to keep playing games and being available and be reliable domestic high-level performers, even though they're not going to be playing Black Caps, or maybe they're aspiring to play Black Caps, but this is how you do that. And also, as far as I checked it up while you're talking there, as far as I can tell, Neil Wagner hasn't played a Super Smash game since 2019, so probably won't see him.
Someone who is returning to Super Smash is Kyle Jamieson, so that Ooh. Adds intrigue. He's playing for Auckland.
Interesting.
And if you can, so he's returning from injury, so it'll be fascinating to see how he performs there. And like, I think for a bowler like him returning from injury, we don't have the speedo, so you can release that. Like, you can, like, is he still bowling the same speed? No idea. Who cares? Don't have that information. What we can look for, how's he swinging the ball? Because when Kyle Jamieson is fit and firing, he's moving the ball into right-handers, kind of hooping it into right-handers away from lefties. He can move the ball both ways. And he's obviously, I don't think his best bowling is him hitting the deck and bowling bounces. It's more bowling a fuller length and getting extra bounce from his height. So just looking for some of those signs, especially the ball movement, because he Like, you can still swing the Super Smash ball in the first few overs, and if that's happening, Kyle Jamison's going to swing the ball as long as he's everything's all good, and that would be an interesting indicator. Thinking back to the Wagner and Patel stuff, Will Young, I think, is part of the Black Caps pivot in a weird way because they pivoted away from him.
Yeah, and Devin Conway test opener now, so.
And it's all good, like, because I've said many times, the three best batters in Aotearoa, Kane Williamson, Tom Latham, and Devin Conway, that's your top three in Test cricket. You want your best batters facing the most deliveries, all good. I feel the most confident about a Black Caps team with those three in the top three batting slots. And Will Young also dominates domestic cricket. Like, he hit five sixes in the Super Smash, and then he comes out in the Ford Trophy. Century have kind of already wrapped up the game because Ben Smith scored a shitload of runs and Brad Shimoli and the Underground King also scored a lot of runs in that game. And then Will Young comes out and he just hits a couple sixes to finish the game. So, and I get this vibe, like, anytime Will Young comes back to domestic cricket, the runs are on, and he's also bullying the domestic circuit with those run scoring. It's not like Will Young comes back and he's like cruising along, he'll hit a couple boundaries and he'll just find his way through an innings. Limited overs cricket right now, Will Young is bullying bowlers. Because if you bowl a bad delivery, he's hitting you for six. And that used to be like a Pukekura Park thing. Then he did it at Eden Park. So, okay, yeah, you know, it's quite easy to hit sixes at Eden Park. Well, then he did it in the Ford Trophy for a little flash there as well. And he's done it over multiple seasons. And that's what I'm thinking with these guys who are around the Black Caps. And this is what is curious about Neil Wagner, because Neil Wagner didn't dominate Plunkett's Shield to start the season. He did take some Ford Trophy wickets, but again, he did not dominate. So then he goes to Pakistan, plays one test and is okay. He's not, like, eye-catching. Yeah, Neil Wagner's back in the Black Caps. It wasn't that. Ajaz Patel hasn't taken a lot of wickets since the Mumbai Magic. And he also has not dominated domestic cricket with his spin bowling. And in both cases, there have been other seamers who do dominate. There are other spinners who do dominate. I think Wagner and Ajaz Patel are among Aotearoa's best cricketers, but they don't have that kind of repertoire of recent domination of domestic cricket. On the other hand, I do see that with Will Young. Hard and fast, is there anyone else who strikes you, whose name pops into that your head wildcard along that line of thinking? Because I think Tom Blundell, he does dominate domestic cricket. Is there anyone else there?
Well, I think maybe the best example of it is Tom Latham, who seems to, every time he pops up for Canterbury, first he likes to pop up for Canterbury.
I'm thinking like just players who are out of the Black Caps. Like, Tom Latham's best batter in the world. But, like, is there someone who's fallen out?
Yeah, I mean, you expect him to come back and do that. Kyle Jamison is someone who doesn't play that much things since he cracked the Black Caps, but before that, he was absolutely destroying stumps. Like, specifically, not just destroying batters, but destroying their stumps. I remember him getting a hat-trick just a few months before he started, like, cementing himself in the Black Caps thing. I don't know. From that sort of on-the-fringes level, I think that might actually be a bit of a factor, is that some of these guys don't. Jacob Duffy's having a good season. He didn't last year, but he was before that. He's sort of had a good season, got picked for the Black Caps, and then form fell off, but he's been good this year. And he generally, throughout his recent seasons, has been someone on that similar caliber. Dane Cleaver is another one who smacks big runs. Probably would put Cam Fletcher over the last couple of years, since we're talking wicketkeepers. There are a few. Sometimes you want to see it a little bit more though from some of those guys, but it's also tricky to adapt your game once you've had a taste of the internationals. We might be starting to see it from Ratchim Ravindra though. Haven't seen it consistently to this point, but we might be starting to.
And I have had Ravindra in MVP status as, like, I think it was Blundell to start the season when he was playing a lot of Plunkett's Shield, and now Ravindra is playing all three formats, and he is in true essence of the most valuable player, I think he is second. Because I think Dean Foxcroft is the most valuable Super Smash player, considering he's top two for runs and wickets. And fantastic, but I think Ravindra is right there, and as you say, like, he's just all class in domestic cricket. So big up him. Big up everyone else. Big up Aotearoa. Big up the sunshine. Big up the rain. Autumn, spring, light, dark. It's all there for you.
All the above.
Big up the Nishkation. Big up yourself. Kia kaha, stay beautiful. Cha-cha.